Hey folks, this is Scott Weingart, and this is an MCRIT podcast. This is another non-clinical podcast. I promise this is going to be the last one for a while, and I'm actually going to give you a clinical topic either tomorrow or Wednesday. So if you're like, what the hell, MCRIT now is just talking about mind crap, no, don't you worry. We'll have some patient-oriented stuff very shortly. But some recent events, both in the U.S. political system, we're not going to talk about politics, don't worry about it, and also in my personal engagement on the web, has led me to want to do a show on argumentation, logical fallacies, and the misery that is Twitter. We'll get there in a second. Before we start, we have just started selling tickets for Reanimate 3. That is the ED ECMO and ECPR and REBOA conference I do with my friends Joe Bellezzo and Zach Shiner in San Diego. This will be the third one, hence the Reanimate 3. The first one, we were trying things out, we were seeing how it goes, and it went amazingly. I mean, this was one of the best conferences I'd ever been to, and I didn't know how it was going to be, because you never really know how things are going to turn out until you actually do it. It turned out great. The feedback was amazing. R2 is going on next month, sold out instantly upon releasing the tickets, and it's going to be even better. We changed our focus purely to resuscitative techniques. We're not talking about any VV ECMO stuff anymore. It's purely what you would need as an ED doc or intensive care doctor if you want to take a patient crashing on you or actually in arrest and get them onto ECMO and then potentially hand them off in an hour or two to whoever is actually going to be taking care of these patients long term, whether it be CT surgery or the different ICU than you're in. But this will teach you how to temporize the patient on pump and get them to the next level of care. It is hands-on, it is logistical, just as you'd expect from anything that I'm involved in. And if you've heard Joe or Zach speak either on my podcast or on all the other venues they speak on, you know our focus is the focus MCRIT listeners want. So if you're interested, come to mcrit.org/reanimate and understand we started releasing tickets a day or so ago and they probably will be sold out by the end of this week if past conferences are any indication. So check it out now. mcrit.org/reanimate. Look at the course and see what you think and consider coming and joining us in San Diego in March of 2017. The first topic to talk about is how to argue, both how to argue in person, but especially how to argue on the internet, because the internet leads to bad arguments. And the reason it does so is because people have a veil of anonymity, whether it's true or not, whether they're actually putting their name on it or not, they're still not facing the person they're talking to. And just the nature of the internet leads people to say things that they wouldn't normally say in a manner they wouldn't normally say them if the discourse was in another medium. Even in written letter, I think there's some degree of tact that gets lost with internet dealings. And as we'll talk about shortly, things are even worse when you're limited to 140 characters. But there are rules out there for the best ways to argue. And I've come across quite a few of them in my rather diverse reading regimen, and I want to share a few and see what you think about them and maybe just make the arguments that we all deal with in the phone world a little bit better. The first set of rules I want to discuss came from a guy named Dan Dennett in his amazing book, Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. This is one of those books that you could pick up every now and then and just read a chapter. The chapters are like 2-3 pages long, and it just makes you think in a way you weren't thinking before, hence intuition pumps. And one of the chapters is called Rappaport's Rules, How to Compose Successful Critical Commentary. And you can see the whole chapter in the show notes. Just follow the link for Rappaport's Rules. And the first rule is probably the most important. You should attempt to re-express your target's position so clearly, vividly, and fairly that your target says, thanks. I wish I'd thought of putting it that way. So think about that for a second. Before you get to rebut, before you get to respond to your spouse, you have to state what they just said, but not in their exact words, in a way that if there is any room for clarity, you've made it even clearer, and in a way that gives them an opportunity to actually respond and say, no, that's actually not what I was saying at all. Now, what this first rule is analogous to a term that's in the debate and logical fallacy world called steel manning, as in man of steel. It's also called the principle of charity. And it's exactly like that first Rappaport rule has said, that you take your opponent's argument, and if there's any room to actually make their argument clearer, more precise, and get their agreement before going into why you think it's not true. This is directly opposite of a rhetorical technique called straw manning. And in straw manning, what you do is you take your opponent's argument, you weaken it, you make it a little bit more laughable, a little bit more silly, and then you debate that new argument you created, as if you're debating a scarecrow, a man of straw, rather than, you know, a fully formed man or woman. And you could see why this is the opposite of steel manning, because in steel manning, you're actually making their argument better and then still knocking it down. And in this one, you're actually making it worse. And you know you've done it when your opponent or the person you're disagreeing with says, that's not what I said, or that's not what I meant. But you just ignore that and continue going. So that's the first of Rappaport's rules. The second, you should list any points of agreement, especially if they are not matters of general or widespread agreement. Imagine what that's going to do to someone you're debating if you say, well, here's the parts of what you said that I think are absolutely true. Number three, you should mention anything you have learned from your target. And then number four, only then are you permitted to say so much as a word of rebuttal or criticism. Now imagine if the last argument you've had, the last debate you've had, was run according to Rappaport's rules. How much more enjoyable, how much more convivial would it have been? Now, in a similar vein is The Hierarchy of Disagreement by Paul Graham, and you could see the actual picture at mcrit.org/180. But it actually has a hierarchy in arguments of possible responses from the lowest, and it's actually a pyramid, this hierarchy, because it's the most common, which is name-calling, and then slightly up to ad hominem, which is where you, instead of debating the argument made by your opponent, you actually debate their character. So ad hominem against man attacks. Responding to tone. You sounded sarcastic. You sound like you don't care. But those should be really functionally irrelevant to the arguments being made. Next up, contradiction, which you just basically, you just say the opposite, but you don't have any support, any evidence, any real weight to your side of the argument, except that you just don't feel they're right. Counter-argument, which is where you contradict and then back up with reasoning or supporting evidence. Refutation, you find a mistake in what your opponent said. Now, this is a higher level than a counter-argument, because not he said, she said, or she said, she said. It's actually finding a flaw in their logic or their evidence. And then for Graham's pyramid, refuting the central point, which you actually don't go to tangential areas of what your opponent is saying, but actually go right to the heart of the matter and show where there's a mistake. And then I've added to the hierarchy that the Man of Steel emblems, the S of Superman, because steel manning before refuting the central point actually would be the highest part of the hierarchy. What about some things that may be a more soft style of shaping the debate than going head-to-head with your opponent? A question that's been put out there in numerous different forums to ask during a debate is to ask, what would you need to change your mind? What would actually be enough to sway you from the belief you've just expressed? This is interesting. It allows a philosophical exploration of how strongly their beliefs are held and whether it's truly based on evidence or not. All right, we've briefly discussed how to argue, how to debate. Let's talk about how not to. And this fits into the category of logical fallacies. And logical fallacies are rhetorical tactics or inadvertent or things that people are actually unaware of used in the course of arguments. And some of them are formal logical fallacies, like suppositions are being made from premises that just aren't true. You know, all eagles are birds, therefore all birds are eagles. That's a formal logical fallacy. It doesn't work that way. And then there's the informal logical fallacies. One of them, the straw man technique we talked about earlier. There's a wonderful book that I bought and hope to share with my son when he's old enough to really start exploring a curriculum in critical thinking, called An Illustrated Book of Bad Arguments. And it is a delight. You can find it in the show notes, but it really goes through all these logical fallacies with amazing illustrations. And anyone who considers themselves to be a critical thinker should pick up a copy of this and put it on their bookshelf. And I also have some, there's the Ten Commandments of Rational Debate in the show notes. But I want to talk about three logical fallacies, and I actually have an example of why I'm talking about them. And they're the three logical fallacies I find that show up most often on debates in the foam world and especially on Twitter. And two of them are omnipresent in the areas of debate and rhetoric. And one of them, I think, is much more common in medicine than other areas, though science as well. The first two are status quo bias and bad Bayesian bias. And I coined that second one. I don't know if there's a better term or an analogous term out there, but that's the best I could do. Status quo bias. This is a key one to understand. We have, in general, a feeling that if things are disagreeing with our current state, our current way of doing things, they are innately bad ideas, and they need a much higher level of proof than what we're doing at status quo. And this is a very dangerous trap to fall into. For instance, epinephrine for cardiac arrest. The standard dose, 1 milligram every 3 to 5 minutes. How much evidence should it take to change that dose to make it less? Well, you know, if you've been doing cardiac arrest for 20 years using that dose, logically, in your head, you may say, wow, it really should take a lot of evidence. But that's falling into status quo bias. If, on the other hand, you ask yourself, well, have I ever looked at the evidence where that 1 milligram every 3 to 5 minutes came from? I mean, I know ACLS says that's the way, but ACLS has a history of putting things out there that may or may not have fantastic evidence behind it. What is actually the evidence? And when you find out it was a single dog study for all intents and purposes as the only key evidence for that dose, well, then it doesn't really take very much. And if there was a single human trial that maybe gave a pathway to giving less epi, with all of our evidence mounting that epi may be harmful in excess during cardiac arrest, then it should take very little to change your mind to this new strategy that actually had a human trial. And this is where I change my mind to, once I have an A-line, giving the hemodynamic optimized doses of epi based on my arterial line tracing during CPR. Because once I looked at what the previous evidence was for the status quo, it's very easy to see that it should take very little to knock that down. The next one, the bad Bayesian bias. I've spoken in other venues when I talk about evidence medicine about Bayesian analysis, the concept coined by the Reverend Thomas Bay. And there's a great discussion of this by Rich Cardin on the St. Emlyn's site, and you can find that linked in the show notes. But to reduce it to its simplest terms, the concept that Bayes proposed is that everything should be judged when you have new evidence in the face of your existing level of belief prior to that new evidence. And that going from new study to new study while ignoring the existing support out there is a very dangerous thing to do, no matter how potent the current evidence looks. And so the bad Bayesian bias is doing that. It's taking one new study, one new idea, and ignoring everything that came before it. Now, you could see how status quo bias and bad Bayesian bias interact nicely, because in some sense, the status quo is not Bayesian support unless that actually counts as evidence. So these two are always kind of in some degree of opposition to each other, because it's very easy to think that 20 years of experience is actually feeding in just on its own merits to your Bayesian supposition. And it very well might be. For instance, if it was a situation where you were actually able to see immediate harm, then 20 years of experience with a medication like Epi would actually feed into good Bayesian support. So, for instance, if there was a new case report published in the Journal of Resuscitation saying that administration of Epi could cause patients' heads to explode immediately, well, your 20 years of experience with Epi would actually feed into that. Like, maybe something else caused the patient's head to explode in that case report, because you've seen not only your 20 years of giving Epi and never seeing a patient's head immediately explode, but all of your colleagues and all of the people at all the conferences you've ever spoken to, and every bit of evidence going there supports your clinical experience. Okay, I agree. Now, the harms we had actually talked about in the status quo bias of epinephrine are things that you can't see instantly. They're things like the degree of cardiac stunning in the post-arrest, the actual amount of blood flow going to the brain rather than the heart. They're things you can't directly observe. So your experience should not feed into a Bayesian push towards believing that our current dosing of Epi is good. And then the last of the three, benefit harm evidence equalization. Another one I had to coin. This is the erroneous belief that the amount of evidence you need to demonstrate benefit is the same you need to demonstrate harm. And that is a woefully inadequate understanding of how evidence works. You see, the amount of evidence for benefit needs to be dramatically greater than the evidence of harm. Now, this is for a few reasons. One, our leanings towards all the ethics of medicine is to, at all costs, avoid the causing of harm unless the benefit far outweighs that potential harm. Hence why so many folks in the foam world are against TPA for ischemic stroke. But it's another reason as well. It's usually easier to see demonstrable benefit than perceive rare harm. And so as a result, even a small spark of harm, the intimation of it should make you worried, while the intimation of benefit should make you put aside a potential treatment until a far stronger support comes. So let me give you the example that brought me to discuss this logical fallacy section. A few weeks ago on the podcast, with the help of my friend George Kovach, I had stopped recommending bougie holdup during the performance of scalpel finger bougie cricothyrotomy. And this was due to the intimation of harm in a Twitter thread saying that there's really nothing in the hands of an inexperienced practitioner that will discern between holdup generated by being in the tracheobronchial tree as opposed to being in the soft tissues of the neck. And in the hands of a very experienced practitioner, yes, it's very easy to discern the difference. But this made me leery because it's going to be people who are incredibly adrenalized and probably have never done the procedure before who most need to perform a cricothyrotomy. So then George went to his cadaver lab and actually tested it, and it is possible to get hold up while you're entirely outside the trachea. And so then I stopped recommending this technique. So there was a few people on Twitter, one in particular, who immediately said, "Don't agree with it," and it referring to my change in my recommendation. "It's a knee-jerk, jump-the-gun decision." Okay. You know, I didn't choose to respond to that because it's not a knee-jerk, jump-the-gun decision. I actually thought about it quite a bit, and being that I was one of the prime people recommending the holdup, I think I was probably in a good place to judge whether or not there was good evidence for it in the first place. And there's not. The evidence was extrapolated from things like, we know it works wonderfully for tracheal intubation from the mouth, because there's only two places it could be in that case. It could be in the patient's tracheobronchial tree or in their esophagus, very different than during the cric, where it could be in the third location, soft tissues of the neck. And because in my own experience, which was fairly extensive, I can feel the difference between being in the soft tissues with a bougie and being in the trachea. But that's not extrapolatable. I have a lot more experience as a surgical intensivist trained to do tracheostomies and because I've done a bunch of crics. So I ignored that tweet. And then I got an email. And I got to say, the person who tweeted and sent this email is incredibly nice. I'm sure quite smart. And I I think in the face of seeing how logical fallacies can easily work their way into even the most intelligent and erudite folks, that I have no problem with any of this. But let me read you the email. Hey, Scott, I'm sorry for calling you out on Twitter like that, but the stance you have taken in regards to hold up conflation, I'm not sure if that means confirmation, in bougie crike is a kind of a load of crap, sick. I mean no disrespect when I say that because I trust you a ton, I do my own fact-finding as well. But to me, that seems way out of character for you to watch a video of someone else, not you, performing a skill very incorrectly, and then allowing that to change your game plan. This is very sensitive ground you're walking on here, and people will take this a run without even trying to wrap their head around what they just saw. This is where social media could be problematic. In the end, hold up isn't the problem. It's a lack of appropriate training that is the issue. We can't allow the lowest common denominator to win here. We have to consistently make sure that the bar is held high. Again, no disrespect, but I felt I had to speak up. Thanks for your time. Okay, so that's the email. Now, look at that in the face of the three logical fallacies we just discussed. Status quo bias. Well, you know, we've been recommending this holdup for a couple of years now. Well, there's your status quo. But bad Bayesian bias, because there was no evidence to support it except extrapolation from other things. Now we have some evidence. Is it fantastic RCT evidence? No, but it doesn't take much to overcome no other evidence except extrapolation of clinical experience. And then here's where the benefit-harm evidence equalization comes in. This is a supposition that harm can be caused, that someone inexperienced who doesn't know what a bougie feels like in soft tissue could easily be in the wrong place and inflating into the mediastinum. Doesn't sound good. Doesn't take much on the benefit-harm equation to push me to say, don't do this anymore, especially since it's not a key part of the procedure. The real confirmation comes from your finger touching cartilage at its tip, the back of the cricoid ring, and with a circle of cartilage around it, the ring of the actual tracheal cartilage structures, the thyroid and your cricoid. That's your confirmation, and then you feel the bougie slide along your finger. I don't need the holdup. This was an easy decision. It's a decision not made lightly. It's just a decision made easily. All right. That's my piece on logical fallacies. Check out the show notes if you want to hear more. Last but not least, Twitter. There is a manual for Twitter. It's called the Missing Manual, and it'll explain all the ways that we are getting it wrong in the foam tweets because it's killing me. And I wish I could get off Twitter. In fact, I very rarely read Twitter except the people who at mention me, and that's just because people are asking questions and stuff. Now, the real problem is lately, and it's been a problem for years, but lately people are doing these 70, 80, 350 thread tweet debates, and I get at mentioned at the beginning, and no one ever takes me or anyone else who got roped into this particular debate. So please read the manual. It's at mcrit.org/180. But just some pieces of it that are important. If you're responding to yourself because you're trying to get away from the 140 character limit, don't respond to the original tweet. Respond to your own tweet. And then it gets threaded beautifully. If people haven't responded after the first round of debate and you were at mentioning them and now you're replying, just take them off. And then if you want a debate where everyone can follow, make a unique hashtag, put that there, and get rid of everyone's at mention so you actually have space to say the things you want to say. Or better yet, put a link up to Reddit or somewhere similar where you could have a multi-character discourse where people could see the threaded responses and actually understand what the hell you're trying to say, as opposed to wasting hundreds of tweets saying, no, that's not what I meant. I was just limited by character space. So please, please make Twitter better. And at the very least, just stop putting me in these debates unless... you know, I answer after the first one or two rounds. Just take me off, please. Okay, enough self-serving crap. Wow, I've already gone over, and I thought this was going to be a super short one. Tomorrow or Wednesday, clinical stuff. Please check out the Reanimate course, mcrit.org/reanimate. Will take you to the conference page. That's mcrit.org/reanimate. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.